Support for the Radio West podcast comes from Harmon's Grocery, offering the Harmon's app, where customers can shop online while choosing favorites, clipping coupons, and checking out at a convenient time. Harmon's, quality delivered.
We Utahns pay a lot of attention to the weather. And maybe everyone does, wherever you are. But when you live in a dry state out here in the West, where water has shaped the land and the culture, the stakes can feel a lot higher. Around here, we count on winter to set the stage for the water year. And it was objectively a terrible winter this year. So now, as the growing season gets underway, a lot of people are looking at their yards and their gardens, and they're wondering what the season is going to look like. What's still possible? What needs to change? How to adapt to a different reality? And this is what Daryl Lindsay does. She's a sustainable landscape designer, and her work is all about helping people rethink their relationship with the landscape, working with the ecosystem you have instead of fighting against it, which often means letting go of ideas about what a yard is supposed to look like and embracing what actually makes sense here, like collecting and using rainwater, something one of Daryl's clients was interested in but wasn't sure just how much of a difference it could make.
He's very interested in rainwater collection, both active with tanks or cisterns or something, as well as passive. And he asked me, how many gallons can he legally harvest in a tank in Utah? And I said 2,500 gallons if you have the appropriate permission and permits. He scoffed a little bit. It was sweet, but it was sort of like, oh, but we're never going to get that much. And I got to look at him and smile and say, hey, I think one or two rainstorms and you're going to fill up 2,500 gallons off of your roof alone, because a 1,000 square foot roof harvests 600 gallons of water per inch of rain. And if we're not in a drought year, we can expect roughly 22 inches of rain in northern Utah, plus snow melt. And that's thousands upon thousands of gallons. And he had a couple thousand square feet of roof.
So you did the math for him. Mm-hmm. You're like, let's work this out.
Yeah. And it's really simple, like length times width times depth. So if you've got 1,000 square feet of roof and then you multiply that by 1 inch, which is 1 divided by 12, that's cubic feet, and you convert that to gallons, and that's how many gallons of water you're getting per inch of rain.
His reaction was what?
Oh, mind blown. We began to make plans together for where we were going to place those tanks, how quickly they were going to fill up, and then once they were full, if it rained again, where would that overflow go into the landscape? And this sort of beautiful dynamic design began to take shape. And it's a really fun thing on a single call, especially when you've got the iPad out and you're drawing on top of photos and stuff, to see the client see that vision come to life. Something clicks. I think it is surprising to people, and was surprising to me the first time I learned how much water a single impermeable surface can harvest, no matter where you are. And I learned that there were entire neighborhoods in Tucson, Arizona, that survive off of zero supplemental irrigation, despite being in the middle of the Sonoran Desert. And if they can do it down in Tucson, we can absolutely do it here. There's just an education gap. People don't know. Yet. I think culturally, we're still very much tied to a simple green lawn and a couple of flower beds with some mulch that you put your petunia and your daisy in. But when you have a bunch of mulch and a petunia and a daisy, those weeds are going to try to come in right around them the second it blows in on the wind. And a sustainable design is trying to leverage what nature's actually trying to do, because that weed seed is something we call a pioneer species, and it's floating in on the wind trying to stabilize disturbed soil. So how do we get your soil not disturbed so that weeds don't feel, I love to give weeds feelings in this analogy, but the weeds feel like they're doing such a good job because they're stabilizing it for you. And I'd rather have native plants that you like looking at be doing that work instead. And the same thing goes for the rainwater harvesting, for the types of lawn that people can use, the densely planted native flowers. People don't realize that these systems, and they are systems that are designed to all work together, they're meant to mimic nature's processes so that you don't have to work as hard and you don't have to water as hard. Whereas our traditional landscaping keeps us in this cycle of, you know, what people would call the definition of insanity, where you just keep going from disturbed soil, weeds, rip them out, the soil's disturbed again, over and over and over again, pulling your hair out every single time.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, Daryl Lindsay is back with us with ideas and answers to some of your questions. And we got started with the obvious question, just how it was she was thinking about this past brutal winter.
Winter is the time that Utah builds up all of its stocks and reserves of water, and most of it is snowpack, and we don't have it this year. And that is really scary for a lot of reasons. Reasons that feel very zoomed out and systemic when it comes to climate change, but also really zoomed in when we're talking about the health of individual yards. Yeah. For people who have already converted their landscapes to drought-tolerant native landscapes, this season won't be that scary. Those yards are already equipped to handle long periods of drought, as native plants have been doing for millennia in cycles. For people who still have those quote-unquote traditional yards, primarily Kentucky bluegrass and a Japanese maple and what have you, and I do love a maple. I'm not trying to hate on maples, but you know what I mean.
Yeah. Plus, they're in their yard anyway, right?
Exactly. Yes. This season might be stressful because our reserves of water are low, and we're likely to see voluntary or even mandatory restrictions on water use this summer as far as irrigation. They're likely not going to restrict culinary water use inside a house. And for watersheds and clients who are accessing water via secondary water, where they actually have an irrigation water connection, there are some conservancy districts that may shut that water off.
Weber
probably is the smallest of the reservoirs. And we saw that a couple of years ago. Yeah. One of my first years in business, I got a lot of clientele from up near Ogden, Plain City, far west, because their secondary water had turned off and their yards torched. The bluegrass died and then field bindweed moved in. And they said, well, we have to redo our yards anyway. We might as well design them to a standard that can withstand the next drought. Yeah. And I'm actually really excited to check in with those clients this year because their landscapes are now 3 years old or more. And we get to see how their new climate resilient landscape holds up in the face of a similar situation or maybe even a far worse situation.
Do you think about coming into a drought differently than coming into a normal water year?
As a sustainable landscape designer, not necessarily, because even when we have an amazing snow year, which we did a couple of years ago, I know that that water, it should be released to the lake. And regardless, we're designing landscapes that are going to be looking their best 2, 3, 5 years from now. And those are the landscapes that may need to hold up in the face of drought. And we know, so like the stock market, there's ups and downs, but the trend is trending. And we're trending towards a hotter, drier, less predictable climate. So we need to keep designing landscapes in that direction.
One of the things that you've been doing, I've noticed lately, is trying to sort of talk people down from the ledge who are really freaking out because it's been so dry and they're not sure what's happening and they don't feel like they maybe are prepared quite yet. But and maybe we can start with this thing that you've been saying quite recently, which is don't water your lawn until May.
Yes.
Which seems so counterintuitive this year.
Yes, because it's been hot and dry.
Yeah.
Yes. The lawn doesn't need it right now. Bluegrass lawn has been technically kind of out of dormancy because it's a cool season grass, but everybody knows your lawn doesn't usually look its best until late March or early April. And bluegrass itself, as far as the health of the plant and the root, it doesn't care if that looking its best happens in April or May.
Right.
It's going to keep looking the way it's looking until we turn those sprinklers on and it's going to bounce right back. You'll see that flush of green a week later once the sprinklers go on. However, that might not be the case if we run out of water in June and people's secondary water connections turn off in July, then that bluegrass is going to die back, and field bindweed and things that can withstand extreme drought, most of which are invasive species, are going to come in and take over. And so it's easy right now to save water. It will not harm your landscape to do it. It might harm it later. Yeah. And so it's really important that we collectively don't turn our sprinklers on. If we collectively waited, if we're talking about the thousands and tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of homes that don't do this, it's millions and millions of gallons that could be reserved for those conservancy districts to release to us later in the summer.
Do water your trees, though.
I do water my trees. Yeah, yeah. 5 to 10 gallons a week, depending on how mature it is. You can use a 5-gallon bucket to measure. My hose bib is winterized, so it's not even turned on. I just fill up a 5-gallon bucket in my sink and walk it out to the tree. It's easy peasy.
All right, let's come back to rainwater and talk a little bit about some of the, I think people are going to want to get a sense of how to go about this. First of all, is it complicated? Does it have to be complicated? And what are the rules?
For harvesting rainwater.
For harvesting rainwater.
There are some rules as it pertains to active harvesting, which means collecting water from your roof via your gutter, your downspout, into a tank or a barrel or a cistern or something like that. If you do not want to apply for any sort of permit or
permission. So you need a permit, though.
Above 110 gallons.
Okay.
So you can have 2 55-gallon barrels, and many cities and municipalities will actually provide those for you at cost. Salt Lake City does that every year. Murray does that every year. But if you want to harvest a larger amount, which if this is something you're really into, that can be fun and exciting, you can have up to 2,500 gallons of water. And that brings us back to that anecdote from the gentleman I was speaking to who didn't think he could fill up 2,500 gallons because of how dry and desert-like Utah seems to be. But when we're talking about 2,000 square feet of roof, that's 1,200 gallons of water per inch of rain. So if we have an inch rainstorm, which is a pretty heavy rain for Utah, but once you have that, we're halfway to that mark. So that's why I'd want to talk to people a lot more about passive rainwater harvesting, which is actually using earthworks, and it's not even dramatic earthworks. It's creating flower beds that are 3 inches lower down than your other flower beds where the water will end up while it's raining.
Wait, say more about that because I'm really interested in that. What you're saying is basically it's going to take a little bit of elbow grease, but you got to get out there and lower things a bit.
Yes. Yes. It's very common in Utah, people who have quote unquote water issues or standing water or boggy soil or what have you.
A basement that floods.
Yes. You put in a French drain. You send the water to the street.
I've got one.
Really? Okay. Well, Dave, we need to look at your
Well, I was worried about that. I'm like the typical person. I was worried we would get flooding every once in a while.
And so yes.
It's actually headed into the backyard, so it's not on the street. But yeah.
Oh, great. Well, that's great.
Yeah.
You could output that downspout 10 feet away from the foundation so that it doesn't flood into the basement.
Yeah.
And then anywhere from that 10-foot point out, we can slow that water down. And that could just be, if you think of it like the rise and fall of topography, little speed bumps, a couple inches up, a couple inches down. And then in the down parts, you can plant drought-tolerant, resilient, herbaceous plants like a native grass and a native flowering perennial. Those plants, if they get water when they need it while it's raining, they can withstand 6 weeks of drought once established. So you can reduce the need to irrigate those areas completely. And I'm interested in passive harvesting much more than active, although I am certified in rainwater harvesting design and I can design an active system as well. Because like we talked about with that client of mine, 2 1-inch rainstorms and his 2,500-gallon tank is full, which means that tank is full and the pressure is going to just be pushing into overflow from that point. So where's all that water going for the next rainstorm and the rainstorm after that? And if people aren't building a 2,500-gallon tank and they have a 50-gallon barrel, that's full the first time it drizzles.
Right.
So let's think about the overflow because that's thousands upon thousands of gallons of water that we could be leveraging in our landscape before we need to even think about turning our irrigation water on.
Where do you start? Like first thing, to walk out there in terms of thinking about this. I'm guessing they're thinking about budget. They're thinking about how complicated they want to be. Do you say go passive before you go active?
Yes.
Or like, okay. So
100%.
Okay.
To me, active active harvesting is almost a nice to have. Of course, in an ideal world, we would all have a gorgeous rain tank and it would be incredible. We'd be conserving so much water. However, they're complicated sometimes. You have to think about freeze thaw. You have to think about cleaning it out, filtration, etc. Passive harvesting, we're pointing your downspout at dirt. Nine people out of 10 listening to this, their downspout's probably already pointed at some dirt. I would just like that dirt to be strategically graded so that it ends up where plants can grow and thrive. It's why I am not a huge fan of the dry riverbed phenomenon, because people point their downspouts at gravel that they want to keep beautiful as a focal feature. But if you're pointing your water there, plants will want to grow. So now weeds are coming up through the gravel. So instead, I could do the same thing where maybe we put a bunch of little low-growing grasses that kind of create the ribbon effect of a riverbed. But that bed is 3, 4, 6 inches lower down, and the water is staying there and fully percolating into the soil. And a native grass, that's all it needs. It very, very rarely will need supplemental irrigation once it's fully established.
It seems like I see a good number of downspouts that are plugged into like a French drain or a system that's sending it out. Are you seeing a lot of that?
Most of the burying that we see, and it kills me because most of the time it's a soft plastic downspout extension they've buried it. That thing is cracked under there. It's just seeping into the soil 2 feet away from your foundation. And in Utah, it's dry enough here in most places and neighborhoods that that's likely not going to cause lasting damage. But what a waste. We could really be using that water elsewhere. Very rarely do I see in Utah that the water is actually buried from a downspout and then tied into infrastructure, like tied into an aqueduct or a storm drain or something. It's usually just piped via PVC or plastic downspout extension to some sort of pop-up emitter, and then it releases further down in the yard itself. We also use that technique to get water to those, we'll call them rain gardens. I'll also use the term basin or swale kind of synonymously, but it basically means native plants in flower bed lower than usual. We will sometimes, if we need to have functional things like a patio or a pathway or a driveway or something between the house and where we want the rain garden to be, we can bury it in. We usually do triple walled, like a version of PVC so that it doesn't freeze over the winter. Bury it, move it down across the landscape, and then have it pop up near the rain garden, and that's where the water will fill.
How much of a difference can this make? Like, I know you've done the math. How much can you save? Like, how much of a reduction can people actually get to without that much effort?
Without that much effort, 50% is easy. I could blink and you could reduce your water needs by 50% if we were to do some of this minor regrading and get those native plants established. I reduce my front yard's water needs by 90%. And for people who want to be a little bit crazy, they're feeling a little kooky about it, and they want to have a 2,500-gallon tank so that when we do need to supplement in July and August, if the plants are feeling stressed or want to go dormant, they can use their rainwater for those rare moments of supplementation. And so it is 100% possible to have a 100% reduction in the need for irrigation water if you're willing to take those steps. I'm not that intense about wanting every single person to get to that A++ grade. Yeah. If 1,000 of us could get to a C-, we'd be talking collectively about millions and millions and millions of gallons saved. So, like, let's all just do what's easy. And then after that, we can get together and learn some extra crazy stuff.
Right. It's Daryl Lindsay. She's the founder and principal designer at Yard Farmer. It's a landscaping design firm focused on native plants and water conservation. We'll take a quick break. Come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Support for the Radio West podcast comes from Harmon's Grocery, offering the Harmon's app, where customers can shop online while choosing favorites, clipping coupons, and checking out at a convenient time. Harmon's, quality delivered.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. We're marking the start of the growing season on the show today by inviting landscape expert Daryl Lindsay back. We're talking about how you manage a garden in the wake of a really dry winter that usually means a pretty dicey water year. So we're talking about collecting rainwater and a lot of the usual things like native plants and different types of lawns. She's also answering listener questions. So let's get back to the conversation. All right, I want to shift to sort of the design part that you're thinking about. Do you think that people are landscaping for identity?
In their front yard, certainly. I think you're telling a story. Yeah. I think gardens are storytelling the same way that the paint color you decide to put on your front door or your shutters are.
It's a way of telling people something about you.
Certainly. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. And if you have a absolutely emerald green golf course front lawn where you see the mowing marks, people know something about you
right. When
they walk by.
You're type A
Whereas
or whatever.
I live in a 1930s Tudor with 3-foot tall wild rose bushes in it. And I want people to think a witch lives there. I do.
Right.
So you are projecting something in your front yard to the neighborhood. And I honestly think that's kind of wonderful. I think that spending time gardening in my front yard has connected me to my community and my neighbors in a way that that is uncommon in America
totally. These
days.
Yeah.
And I actually know my neighbors' names now because I'm out there with my gardening gloves on and have a chat with Larry as he walks by with his dog. And I think there's something really important and beautiful about that if people want to take that step.
How much do you think the sort of communal neighborhood sensibility or the expectation of your neighborhood, your little community there, shapes the choices that people make about landscaping?
Oh, I think a lot.
Yeah.
I think a lot. I get a ton of clients where in the consult, we are going to design the whole yard, front, back, side, but they say, let's start with the front because our neighbors are getting kind of mad.
Yeah.
And this could be just a new build thing where you've got a bunch of exposed dirt and then the weeds come in and you're thinking about paint colors for your cabinets inside, so there's not time yet.
Yeah.
But then the neighbors start to get mad. And I think this varies community to community and neighborhood to neighborhood. It depends where you live. And I don't necessarily think people should or need to landscape just to please other people.
No. But I do wonder, though, if you are thinking about trying to create something that's more sustainable and your neighbors – look, they've got 6 kids. They have soccer practice. They don't have a lot of time. They have Kentucky bluegrass. Mm-hmm. Don't want to be judged. You know what I mean? Like, I just wonder how that dynamic plays into the larger picture as well.
Yes. I would then walk them through ways we could reduce that maintenance while increasing curb appeal, at least increasing the traditional version of curb appeal. I'm not trying to make it look like a witch lives there
right. In
that house. However, things like if you've got a lot of lawn and 6 kids and mowing the lawn every Saturday takes hours and hours, why is it taking hours and hours? Probably because you're mowing against pathways, fence posts. It's really annoying to push a mower against those. Mowing in circles around trees, irregularly shaped, inefficient lawn. That can take 2, 3, 4 hours with a push mower or walkable mower to do. Whereas if we were to still keep 80-90% of your yard lawn, but just shrink it in to be an efficient shape, and then you have a gorgeous flower border that wraps it, you could walk in a circle for 25 minutes and mow your lawn once a week. And now you've got a couple hours back with those 6 kids.
Here's a question that I was thinking about that was inspired by a question that you got from someone who had reached out. And she said she thought that – she had this mid-century modern house, which she thought was kind of not cool or kind of boring. But it made me think about how you integrate landscaping into the actual style of the house itself. Do you want to say something about this particular case and then how you think more broadly about how you design a garden to match the house?
Yeah, that's something that's really exciting about what I do. And it does tend to blow people's minds when they realize that you can use 100% Utah native plants and you could make it look like a Japanese style Zen oasis or a witch cottage or a Palm Springs mid-century oasis. There's a million ways to do it, and it's all about the way that we frame it, the way that we style it, the colors and textures of plants that we use.
In one of your videos, you said that you like to ask, what is this house telling me?
Yes.
Or telling us, yeah.
Yes. So with helping a client figure out how to style their landscaping, I'd like to find the intersection of what the client likes and what the client likes to look at, and then what the architecture, era, or details of the home are telling us. And so even if a client has really cool modern sensibilities, I'm going to design that yard differently if they live in a 1960s Rambler versus an 1890s Victorian.
Yeah.
And I have done cool kind of modern takes on a cottage garden for people who do live in Victorian homes, but don't love a witchy, cottagey look,
yeah.
But it still looks nothing like if I was designing a Frank Lloyd Wright house. And that brings me back to your original question, which was this client didn't quite realize because of updates that had been made to the home between the 1960s when the home was built and now,
yeah,
that the home actually had a lot of very cool, funky, mid-century modern details. And just restoring those details on the exterior and adding a couple of cool choices in the landscaping, like a cool modern path that zips out straight to the street so that your eye kind of, when you're standing there, goes right up to the front door, and then layering plants in an interesting and modern way that use those like sagey Mediterranean greens and things like that.
Yeah.
It totally transformed the way the house looked. And we drew it out in 3D on the call, and she was over the moon.
One of the things that you've been highlighting recently, something that you saw from another sustainable landscaper that said that she wished more people knew that a densely planted garden is healthier than something that's,
yep,
sparse.
I sing it from the rooftops. 100% plant coverage is,
yeah,
what we are going for.
Yeah.
And that brings us back to that. I don't want to see a mulched bed where the mulch is the feature. We use wood mulch when we're first installing a young landscape because it helps keep the weeds down, it helps keep things watered, or helps keep water in the soil. But the goal is that the plants are going to knit together as they reach maturity and form a living mulch. Because back to that ecosystem succession thing, if there is empty space for a weed seed to blow on the wind and land, then that is disturbed soil, because that isn't what a climax ecosystem you'd find out in nature would look like. Mm-hmm. However, if we have densely planted native plants, and these could look all wild and meadowy, and we've got 14 different ones all mixing together, or it could be chunky mass plantings of some cool modern grasses. But regardless, we've gotten 100% coverage. There's no space for those weed seeds to come in. And even if they make it all the way down there to the base of the plants, there's no light for them to germinate, because the other plants are up here above them.
The thing that we've talked about before, and I think people always want us to come back to some degree, is the lawn. We don't have to spend a lot of time on this question because we've talked a good deal about it. But one of the things you've mentioned before is how much interest – like one of your videos went viral that was got like 4 million views because you had suggested different options.
Mm-hmm.
And people are passionate about this subject.
Mm-hmm.
Why do people feel so strongly about – because grass seems to be like the one thing that people feel so intensely about. It's hard,
yeah,
to let go, or,
yeah,
I don't know. What is it?
The American lawn is a – magnificent cultural phenomenon.
Yeah.
I'd write a book about it, and I will in my
you should.
As
you should.
When I retire, I'm going to write a dense history of the American lawn, because yeah, there's a lot of emotion steeped up in it. I think that post World War II, the single family home and the American dream became the cultural standard,
yeah,
and lawn was the first material used in those initial developments that were the protogenitors of suburbia, of American,
yeah,
suburbia,
right.
Levittown,
right.
New York.
Yep.
And so those things are inextricably linked to each other. I think that for people who don't want to let go of the idea that a pretty green lawn in front of their house is important, they don't want to let go of what that symbolizes to them, that's great. let's just make that lawn more efficient so that it's not needlessly wasting water. You can do that, like I said earlier, by making the shape more efficient. Honestly, that's huge because high efficiency sprinkler heads, if they're correctly aligned, they don't need you don't need to be overwatering and overspraying the way that these crazy networks of sprinklers that we see do. And then we could eventually, if you're open to it, we could explore swapping out that bluegrass for a more better adapted version of turf grass.
There's something that you mentioned I wanted to ask you about. You said that for people who are displaying these big swards of Kentucky bluegrass that are beautifully manicured as a way of sort of showing the opulence and their great material success, you're saying is kind of revealing an actual kind – they're being tricked. Mm-hmm. Because you said it's actually the cheapest thing for a developer to install and it's the most expensive thing for you to
– maintain.
Maintain.
Yes, 100%. That's why it was the material of choice in these mass developments, because sod farms became a thing and a developer could come in, roll it out, say, I'm done, going to go build another one, make another couple billion dollars, goodbye. And then you're stuck figuring out how to water, irrigate, fertilize, mow, spray herbicide on, and you're trying to maintain a standard that is honestly really in conflict with what nature wants. Especially if we keep mowing the lawn so short because the roots can't even get down there to fully establish, which means it's going to be stressed. And the minute it gets stressed, you know what can handle those conditions better than your lawn? A weed. Yeah. And that's why you're finding bindweed and dandelions in your grass. And if your reaction to that is to go get some Roundup and spray broadleaf herbicide on your lawn, we're disturbing the soil, which means weeds are going to want to come in and stabilize the soil. So it's just this endless, perpetual cycle of, I'll say it, insanity. And yeah.
What's your favorite alternative these days? There's so many, and we can go through a few of these here. We've talked about a few before, but these days, what are you really liking as an alternative for Utah? Think more about this region.
Yeah, drought-tolerant lawn alternatives or alternative lawns for Utah. I think I could give sort of two categories of recommendations, and it's important I do because every yard is different.
Yeah.
And if I say a name and you go buy it and it's not right for your yard, I'd hate to see that. There are warm season grasses and cool season grasses. Bluegrass is a cool season grass. There are other cool season grasses that are better adapted and more well adapted to Utah climates. Salt Lake City does a turf trade grass seed that is a Diva bluegrass. That's a cultivar of Kentucky blue mixed in with, I believe, a couple of fescues. That's already 25% more drought tolerant than the average sod. Fine fescue is a cool season grass, also more drought tolerant than bluegrass. So you could overseed your bluegrass lawn with that fescue if you didn't want to change things too much. If you were feeling like starting totally from scratch and you wanted to see big water savings, we need to switch you over to a warm season grass because that grass wants to be out of dormancy and green and lush and soft in the hot months.
But we're a cool season. How can a warm season grass work here? It does.
Well, the warm season starts now. Yeah.
Huh.
So we are tricking our Kentucky bluegrass into thinking that it is the cool season all summer long by dumping water on it. We're trying to trick it into thinking we're Seattle.
Yeah. Yeah.
And we're not. And also Seattle's not getting rain anymore anyway.
True.
Whereas in May, a warm season grass like buffalo grass, you also mentioned dog tough grass.
Yeah, dog tough grass. I don't even know what that is.
That's a hybrid Bermuda grass.
That's a warm season grass.
Yes, it is. And so it breaks dormancy in May, and then it looks really soft and green and pretty. Buffalo grass in particular, as well as dog tough grass, don't really need to be mowed because they max out at 3, 4, 5 inches tall. And if the 5 inches tall looks a little bit rough for you, mow it once every 6 weeks. Mow it a couple times a season to kind of give it a little haircut.
Yeah.
And that's where that rant that you were quoting where I said we were all tricked came from, because why are we all dumping water on this and sacrificing hours and hours and hours a week to the mower if there are products that already exist that do not need to be watered and do not need to be mowed? I hate mowing the lawn.
Yeah. Well, it gets us to some questions that we got from listeners, and this is a good segue because I think you already actually answered this Stephanie's question. This comes from Stephanie, who asks, can I overseed a drought-tolerant mix into my existing Kentucky bluegrass?
You can. You just want to make sure that you're overseeding it with things that are complementary to the bluegrass. Buffalo grass, for example, it is that warm season grass, and it is not shade tolerant at all.
So don't do that.
So don't do that, because the bluegrass will get taller than the buffalo grass, and then the buffalo grass won't ever break dormancy. And you need buffalo grass to break dormancy in May, and that's when the bluegrass is going to be its fluffiest and its tallest, and it's just a terrible combination. But fine fescue or even other sort of lawn alternatives that aren't quite grass but could still look good as a lawn, like turf-type yarrow is a huge one that I love. That is yarrow, Achillea millifolium, native to Utah plant, and our turf-type yarrow maxes out at 6 inches tall. You could mow it couple times a season to keep it at a really gorgeous, like knitted together 2 inches. And it also plays really well with grass. So you could overseed your existing bluegrass lawn with that, or even plant plugs if you want to jump start, where you just sort of aerate your lawn and then drop plugs of the turf type yarrow in the holes.
You know, I'm seeing a lot of clover.
Yeah, micro clover or full on Dutch white clover does great with bluegrass as well. There's actually studies that say that they complement each other, and clover is healthier when planted with grass, and grass is healthier when planted with clover. They're not going to be as drought tolerant as a warm season grass, but they are going to be more drought tolerant than what you have now. And like I said, I'm just trying to get as many people as possible to that C minus. That's where we see collective impact.
Daryl Lindsay, she's the founder and principal designer at the landscaping design firm Yard Farmer. Take a break. Come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Support for Radio West comes from our members. Find out how at KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. We're talking with Utah landscape expert Daryl Lindsay today. She's the founder of the firm Yard Farmer. And this is the beginning of the growing season, which is coming in the wake of what seems to be a not-so-great water year. And we turn to Daryl for insight and ideas about how to work with nature, not against it. And she's also answering your questions. So let's get back to the conversation. All right, let's go back to some questions. This comes from Bill, who says a few years ago he said, I removed almost all of my grass. I planted some foundational plants and I installed drip irrigation. I was planning to fill in some water-wise native perennials this year, but here's his question. Should I wait because of our low water year?
Oh, so you're saying, should I not install these plants because I'd be wasting water establishing them, or they might get too stressed?
Yeah, I'm worried about water restriction impacting my tender new plants given our low water year so far.
Interesting.
Yeah. What do you think?
Yeah. So that note about water restriction is interesting, and we should discuss the nuance there, because if he is on secondary water and there is no water in his yard to establish, we need to have a plan ahead of time for that. However, I think now would be a better time than ever to try to get a drought-tolerant native something established, because if you don't do that, the bindweed's coming.
Yeah.
And I'd rather see a resilient drought-tolerant yard getting established. And the water use that it would take to establish young native plants is still a small fraction of what it takes to keep a bluegrass lawn green. And so I think even collectively, if we could get 10, 20, 30 more people over here to remove their bluegrass and all of them establish native landscapes together, we're still seeing 50% reduction in water use or more, regardless of the restrictions or not. If he is on secondary water and he's worried about his water being turned off, then I think we just need to really plan for that. Is there a hose bib with a culinary water connection that if we're not getting any monsoonal rains this summer, can we use the hose to top it up? And maybe we select from the most drought tolerant of our native plants. Maybe no dogwoods. Let's go like sagebrush and Palmer's penstemon and rabbit brush instead, because there's a chance in the next 3 months, if we could get those plants established, that they might already be equipped to handle drought if that comes around in July or August. Mm.
Okay, great. So with some caveats, don't wait.
Bill. Don't wait.
Yeah.
The best time was 20 years ago, but now we'll do.
Now we'll do. Okay.
And especially if you have bluegrass, don't wait.
Here's something from Crystal. She says, what are your top tips on how to handle animals, deer, rabbits, squirrels eating our gardens of vegetables and fruits and flowers? She wants to plant them, but it can be a little frustrating. Mm-hmm. How do you tell people to handle that?
There's no such thing as a deer-proof plant in Utah. And if it's a vegetable garden specifically, then likely creating some sort of barrier is the only true, tried and true way to do it.
Yeah.
I oftentimes will suggest clients look at timber-framed sort of fencing where you build a wood frame and then you put a mesh panel. They look really attractive and are inexpensive and DIY-friendly.
Yeah.
And then you string a little twinkle light around it. It's gorgeous. However, it could also be helpful if there are deer perusing your yard looking for food. It's because there aren't other food sources available. So it could be helpful to plant things that are deer deterrent, which is, again, there's no such thing as a deer proof plant, near the garden, and then plant things that they might be more interested in that are hardier shrubs and so on further away, depending on how big your property is. You're sort of influencing the way that the wildlife corridor is interacting through your space.
Bill asks a question. Has a 40-foot, 6-foot-tall cedar fence 10 to 12 inches from the sidewalk.
Oh.
Gets tons of dogs that pee on it when they're going to the – because they're close to a dog park. And so his question is, what should I plant that could survive the dog pee?
Okay. So 10 to 12 inches. So it's not a lot of space.
Yeah.
You're going to want to get some sort of hardy ground cover and maybe some other hardy perennials that can hold up. I know Palmer's Penstemon, which it will overhang into the sidewalk. It can get up to 3 feet tall and wide. Mm. Palmer's Penstemon can be quite dog urine resistant. Blue gramma grass has held up quite well.
Gramma grass?
Mm-hmm. Blue gramma. It's just a beautiful ornamental grass. Huh. It has diagonal seed pods on it. Once you see it, you'll recognize it.
Okay.
If we wanted to even then stagger down to ground covers or things, since 10 to 12 inches isn't very much, kinnick, it's a funny name, but it's part of the manzanita family, and it's an evergreen ground cover that's 2 inches tall and mat forming. That would hold up really well. And then maybe get some small rocks, like boulders that can fit within that 10 to 12 inch space that the kinnick can grow around, because that's where the dogs are going to want to pee.
Yeah.
Instead of your plants.
Great. Okay. Good question, Bill. This one from Maria, while we're on the subject of creatures. Is a garden mouse okay? Hard no in the house, she says, or the garage, but I hate the thought of traps in my vegetable beds.
A garden mouse is totally okay.
Yeah.
If you're building an ecosystem, there's going to be an ecosystem.
Right.
Absolutely. And if you take it one step further and you really start layering in a native ecosystem outside of your vegetable garden, you're going to see the ecosystem managers who might take care of the garden mice for you,
yeah.
Which is sad in its own way, but at least you're not the one doing it.
Right.
And at least we're supporting a native food chain. I let some sunflowers get really big in my front yard last year. Remember what I said about the witch thing?
Yeah.
And people ask me all the time, wow, you're creating all of this cover and scrubbiness and shelter. Are you worried about pests, mice, et cetera? And I said, have never seen one. I live pretty close to State Street in a really urban environment, parking lots on all sides. This isn't like I'm up in the foothills. There are Cooper's hawks on power lines above my yard.
Wow.
Because they're managing my ecosystem for me, because that system has fleshed out.
Maria also, this was a good question too, also from Maria, wondering if it's time to make a serious investment in large shade sails for gardens like our southern neighbors.
Permanently installed shade sails, ones that can actually hold up to wind and snow load and things, are an interesting thought. And I don't hate the idea, given the fact that the climate is going to continually trend in our southern neighbor's
yeah.
direction.
Yeah.
In the meantime, looking for attractive options using 40% shade cloth in a vegetable garden that aren't just hanging up that weird black shade cloth that makes it look like there are Harry Potter Dementors flapping around, which I've done. I had to do it to save the tomatoes when it was 100 degrees.
Yeah.
I have a client recently where we designed sort of a almost like a pergola structure, but then it has telescoping screen doors on the side and almost like custom roller shade blinds on the top that she can actually swap out with a tightly stretched within a frame clear plastic in the winter in order to extend the season earlier and later. Wow. And then slide that back and pull the 40% shade cloth in the summer. And so that's creating maybe not a 12-month growing season, but a highly extended, resilient vegetable garden. And it kind of looks like a pergola that you'd want to hang out in and under.
Do you think there's a social tipping point where sustainable landscaping becomes the norm as opposed to the outlier? Do you think there's a tipping point somewhere, however the culture works?
I love that question. I do think we will see that a decade from now or so. The reason I say that is because naturalistic garden design, the style that I use, which leverages native plants but also is meant to be eye-catching and attractive, that is much more popular in other countries. Namely, England, Germany, and Sweden are really pioneering a lot of wonderful things about ecological, perennial first landscape design. They're about 15 years ahead of us culturally on that. I think that we are trending that direction, and with the way that media has changed and people's access to information has changed, we're seeing those gardens and wanting to implement them here sooner than we would have in the past. I don't know what the actual tipping point will be. I don't know if there's going to be a moment where we all wake up and just decide to do it one day.
Yeah.
But I do think we are already at a time where more people are interested in it than they ever have been before. And it's an exponential growth because we've seen this. There are studies when one native landscape comes into a neighborhood, 3 to 4 to 5 will pop up the following year. They've done real analyses on this phenomenon because once you see it, you realize it's possible. And so when one more person gets interested, then again, it's just a compounding interest, so to speak.
Which gets me to my last question. What do you think Salt Lake City neighborhoods, well, Utah neighborhoods, just don't have to be Salt Lake City. What are they going to look like then in 15 years? If we're catching up, what's your realistic?
Yeah.
Not your idealistic, not what you want, what you think it's going to be like in 10, 15 years. What are the neighborhoods going to look like?
You know something? I think that the idealistic vision and what I think is most likely to happen are not so far off. I think as people realize they have to make a change in their yards, we're going to see a lot more color. We're going to see a lot more texture, a lot more interest. I think lawns are going to become less and less popular to the point where there may even come to be a negative stigma associated with them. We already see that in our southern states. In Phoenix, Arizona, if you're watering a bluegrass lawn, your neighbors don't like you.
Yeah.
And so that might repeat up here 15 years from now. I think it's really, really interesting to consider collective impact because a lot of these issues when it comes to drought and water conservation, they feel really scary and systemic and big, and it's about legislation and it's about the lake. And all of that's true. But when we talk about me reducing my yard's water needs by 90%, that was about 90,000 gallons of water per year. And I'm already doing that. If I round that up to an easy 100,000, because math is easier that way, that's 10 people that need to be doing this. 9 other people, in addition to me, for us to be collectively saving 1 million gallons of water a year. And I know more than 9 people are listening to this right now. So this is not something that needs to be so scary that we let ourselves feel jaded and hopeless about it. There are actionable changes that people can make. And then you'll be that first yard to pop up in your neighborhood so that three or four or five more can pop up the year after. And then 15 years from now, I think it might be a little more enjoyable to walk down a regular suburban street in Salt Lake.
Daryl Lindsay, thank you very much.
Hey, thanks.
It's Daryl Lindsay. She's the founder of the landscaping firm Yard Farmer. You can follow her on social media at yardfarmer.co. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. We're on Instagram at Radio West. We're on YouTube at KUER 90.1. You can email us at radiowest@kuer.org. Our intern is Aidan Oneida, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. I'm Doug Fabrizio.